From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, Kojo.
In the wake of all that's been going on around the nation, both in terms of police shootings and police being shot, I think today we need to get right to it because we have a lot to cover and we want to deal with that issue in a local way. First, the mayor and the city administrator of the District of Columbia last week ordered the release of body camera footage from a June 27th incident that included moments when D.C. police officers fatally shot a man named Sherman Evans in Northeast Washington. Joining us now by phone is Matthew Maul. He is the chairman of the D.C. Police Union. Matthew Maul, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me, Kojo.
Matthew, you've said that you object to that video being released before prosecutors could fully review it. Why?
Absolutely. What we do when we release these videos, before we've had a prosecutorial review, before the department has had an opportunity to review exactly what happened by interviewing the officers, I think we're doing the members, my members, a disservice. We are, in essence, creating public opinion. We have to remember these body-worn camera videos are a very small piece to a large and complex puzzle. They show one point of view. They show a little bit of what happened. We don't know what's happened before. The video that was released, we know there was at least 3 minutes before this video where officers were interacting with the subject, pleading to drop the gun and drop the gun. But we miss a lot of information. When these videos are released, the public can now form an opinion on their own without any other type of context as to a full investigation.
Sergeant Maul, this is Tom Sherwood. Thank you for joining us. What is the process? I recall the law that was passed allows the mayor and the chief to release video if they feel it's in the public interest. Is that what happened today? Did the chief and the mayor say this is in the public interest? My understanding is the chief was not happy about the video either.
I'm not 100% sure about that. I would have to review the law. I don't want to speak. I think it's only the mayor that has the ability to release this for public interest in the mayor's office.
What do you see when you look at the video that was released last week?
We're talking the D.C. officer involved shooting?
Yes.
So I look at that video and I see our officers used a lot of restraint during that during the portion
and
of the
video. And I suspect that that's why the mayor decided to release it.
Is that a good thing that maybe that is, as Kojo suggests, the reason the mayor did it, to show what the officers were doing as best as possible in the instant moment?
You know, I don't disagree. I think every one of our use of force videos, our officer-involved shootings, or uses of force that result in serious injury, I think they need to be released to the public in the interest of transparency. But there's a right time to do that, and that's after the investigative process is over, so that we can, along with the video, provide everyone else with the findings of the incident that occurred.
Are you concerned? I immediately think it's a journalist and the people who have cell phone video and release their own versions, that the type of investigation and preparatory work that you're suggesting may drag on too long, may just seem to drag on too long, or in fact may drag on so long if you get into the details of what charges, if any, might be brought against the person who was threatening the police or the police who are responding to the threat. It seems that one of the issues about the police video was to maybe get it out there quicker so people can, in fact, see some transparency in what often can take months of investigation.
I don't disagree with that. You know, we had an incident last year in the 6th Police District where a use of force was caught on a cell phone camera and brought to the department's attention, and the video just replayed a very just a portion of that use of force. What happened in that investigation is the video looked bad. So after the investigation, though, the department was able to learn that the use of force was justified because of what had happened and transpired minutes before this video started to be recorded. I think by releasing the videos and allowing people to see just a very small portion of it does my members a disservice.
Well, when you think about it, it was entirely possible that there could have been a passerby who had a camera who recorded that video, as we have seen in the cases, in particular in Minnesota, where that video becomes widespread and public before any prosecutor any place has a chance to look at it. Is that one of the things that you don't think, don't you think that's one of the things that officials like the mayor have to take into consideration when these things happen?
I do agree, and I guess in the interest of playing devil's advocate like that, you know, that's not what happened in this specific case, and every incident is absolutely different. When there are, as what happened in Minnesota, when that does happen, you know, maybe the mayor at that point can decide what's best, I think, with talking with the police department, the chief, and handling the situation like that. But just to say, I believe this is our first police-involved shooting that was actually caught on body-worn camera. To release it just a little over a week after the incident happened, I think was just irresponsible.
Sergeant Mall, I appreciate your concerns and thoughts about this. I'm just thinking that given the 24/7 nature of news now, given the internet and the ability for anyone to post anything at any time, I'm just wondering if there's if police officers now, I mean, the officers, I think, have overwhelmingly supported the idea of wearing the cameras. Will this, do you think, undercut their willingness to wear them?
I don't think it'll undercut the willingness to wear them. The way I view the body-worn camera program is it appears that in this specific incident, the mayor used it as a tool for transparency. And I think we have to reevaluate what the cameras do, and rather as a tool for transparency immediately, these are actually tools for our officers and our police departments as a tool for accountability, knowing that you do have something recording your every move, your words, and painting a picture to where we can go back and hold the officers accountable for the actions.
Sergeant Mall, given all that's happened this past week, the incidents in Minnesota, Louisiana, the nationwide protests that followed them, the violence against officers in Texas last night, what kinds of conversations have you been having with fellow officers about all of these different things?
So I've reached out to quite a few officers. I'm working out of the 3rd District today, doing some things. And, you know, there's no doubt in our minds that the law enforcement community suffered a horrible tragedy overnight. It's not something that is new to us. We know each and every day that we come to work that it very well could be the last shift that we work. But our officers still come to work every day doing the job that they do. Officers are concerned. They're concerned with the changing climate of police work in the United States. And I think there are times where the media and everyone over reports a few incidents that are horrible incidents, and we kind of all get painted badly as all police officers are bad when that's just not the case. You know, what happened in Dallas last night was an absolute tragedy. I think it's the second most deadly day in law enforcement history in our country since September 11th. The Dallas area lost 5 officers in just a violent slaughter, and it's just unacceptable.
I've watched a lot of cable television, and I mean all versions of cable television. I saw the President of the United States speak from Poland. Almost every person that I heard said, we have to respect police officers and law enforcement and what they do, that they do, in fact, put their lives on the line every day, every hour, every minute, that there are overwhelming number of officers who are, in fact, the officers we want protecting us. But that does not obliterate the need to address the stunning statistics the president spoke of people of color being treated differently than others, whites in America. And can you understand that it's like two magnets that are going opposite of each other? Those somehow or another have to be joined, doesn't it? to reach a solution or some kind of accommodation of how we can get better along and people that, in fact, black lives do matter, and so that we can all be on the same playing field. I just feel like we're not.
I think that's fair to say. Just speaking in D.C., our officers are out in the communities every day. They are from upper Northwest in Georgetown down into the southeast and northeast quadrants of the city that are more plagued by violent crime than other neighborhoods in the city. But our officers are out there every day, and when you see when our officers are out there, when they're on their foot beats or these business beats, you know, the citizens love seeing the police officers. I think the majority of police officers are doing the job for the right reasons. Of course, as with any profession, there are those bad apples in the mix.
Allow me to interrupt because I should tell our listening audience, you are joining the Politics Hour already in progress here. We're talking with Matthew Maul. He's the chairman of the D.C. Police Union. Of course, Tom Sherwood is here. He's our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. If you have questions or comments, we're talking about some controversy over a recently released video of a police shooting here in Washington, D.C. It's 800-433-8850. You can watch the live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org, and send us a tweet or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom?
Sergeant Maul, let me, excuse me, people worry about the Ferguson effect, which came after Ferguson, Missouri, where officers were reluctant to do their jobs because they thought they'd be held to a higher standard without recognition of the danger of their jobs. There's been complaints about the Blue Shield, where officers stick together and protect one another. It just seems to me, as a journalist, you know, it's horrible to me when a journalist lies, fabricates stories, and does horrible things to my business. But in your business, the public safety business, I sometimes wish there were more outrage at the officers who undermine the very hard work that you guys, in fact, do. That's what I would like to see. I would like, as a citizen, shouldn't there be more outrage at the officers who are found guilty of violating the rights of citizens? I think that would reinforce your position that most officers are, in fact, trying to do a good job.
I'd like to underscore that, Sergeant Maul, by saying because a lot of people feel that the thin blue line causes police officers never, ever to be critical of anything other officers do.
Right. I'll say this. Based upon, you know, my past experiences with the police department and what I see now, I mean, The thin blue line, I mean, police officers do a very dangerous job, and they do tend to stick together. But I'll tell you, when a police officer goes out there and does something wrong and his due process is followed and he's either convicted by a court of wrongdoing or internal wrongdoing, the sentiments of police officers are they don't want to work with a bad police officer. They want to work with people who that they can trust and they know, and they are respecting the rights of everyone that we deal with. D.C. is a melting pot of every nationality. We have the various liaison units that the police department has shows that you know we provide a service to different communities, be it race or sexual orientation. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a police officer who doesn't believe that someone who gets found guilty of violating someone's rights or mistreating people shouldn't be on the job.
Matthew Maul is chairman of the D.C. Police Union. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. Joining us in studio is Angela Angel. She's a member of the Maryland House of Delegates. She's a Democrat who represents the state's 25th district, which includes parts of Prince George's County. Delegate Angel, thank you so much for joining us. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
You have spent a lot of time recently organizing an event in Maryland focusing on domestic violence, but I shouldn't go there first because you've been listening to our entire conversation so far, and I'm pretty sure you have some thoughts or comments you'd like to make.
Definitely. You know, it's interesting. One of the questions that I was actually interested in hearing from the officer that was speaking was, what is his reasonable time frame? Because that's there's a constant, like you said, news cycle is constant, and people are wanting to know what happened. And so I understand that, you know, he doesn't want things released immediately, but we have to have, I mean, I think it was a week that until this video was released. And so, you know, what do we consider reasonable before we begin sharing this information? In our society today, as people are videoing, we've seen murders streamed live. And so there's a constant need to have this information, and people want this information. And when you don't deliver it in a timely basis, you do appear to be non-transparent.
So you believe that Mayor Bowser and the district did the right thing?
I would say yes. I mean, I think there clearly was a time frame where there was some internal review of the video, and a decision was made to share it with the public. And I think that was the right decision. As an elected official, I'm sure there were people that were calling various offices asking, you know, for this to be released. And you have a responsibility to follow through with that.
With every minute that passes, there is the time for conspiracy theories to develop. But why won't they show it? Why, if the cameras are working, why can't they show this?
Exactly.
And it should be. And I hope, I didn't see what the mayor's office did in releasing it, but I hope they would say, this is the camera video that we have. It doesn't show everything, and it certainly doesn't show the minutes before the shooting. And I think we need to learn. We're in a transition period where we're getting more information. We have to learn better how to process that information. And if the mayor releases the video and says, this is preliminary, this is early, do not take this and run with it as all that happened, I think we get a better sense of what's happening, and we start giving people information as we get it, just as the Dallas police chief did last night in Dallas.
Exactly. And I think, you know, our citizens and the people are intelligent enough and responsible enough. Yes, there's going to be some people that run away with anything that you give them, but that can understand this is a process, and they respect us being open with them.
You spent a lot of time, as I said earlier, organizing an event focusing on domestic violence in Maryland. Last month, a judge ruled that, we're still talking about police violence here. After the police-involved shootings earlier in the week, I noticed you tweeted that we have to know where to take the fight and use the hashtag police reform is a state issue when it comes to specific things you'd like to see change in Annapolis. Where do you think lawmakers in the General Assembly need to start?
I mean, I think we actually made a lot of great progress last year with the Police Accountability and Reform Bill. There was an entire commission that was done, and then we actually did submit legislation and pass legislation that addressed quite a few of the issues identified by the commission. We're still looking at, you know, things such as our citizen review boards, things such as, you know, an openness in the process for if you want to submit a complaint against police officers in the state of Maryland. There's still quite a few issues that we're addressing. But here in our state, I think we did make a lot of great progress led by the head, Speaker Bush, President Miller in our General Assembly, as well as a lot of advocacy groups that weighed in heavily on the findings of that committee. But the reason why I started the hashtag, because for me, it's very frustrating when I see people saying, call your congressman, let's march in the Capitol. That's not where police reform is going to take place. And when we use our energies in those spaces, we're actually not advancing the issues that we need to advance. And that's why I set that hashtag, and I've been, you know, sharing information. Louisiana has judges that are up for election. The nominating process isn't even over there. If you want to see some changes in the system, become involved, run for office, support those that are running for office that reflect your values.
Here in this city, you know, Kathy Patterson, when she was a council member, I think chairman of the Judiciary Committee, she's now the D.C. auditor. She held a series of hearings on the police department's handling of crowds, particularly because the city had paid out and has been paying out millions of dollars for violations of rights of protesters. But what she did, and I think what Chief Lanier has done, is she altered the way the police are trained in dealing with people. That you just don't go and rush in and arrest anybody who's in your line of sight. And I think the city, the District of Columbia, has benefited from the work that was done back in the early 2000s. And when Chief Lanier, I mean, people were videotaping police officers doing sometimes just routine things, and the officers would overreact and try to stop the people from videotaping. And she wrote something like a 6 or 7 page general order telling officers that if they're on public space and they're not interfering with you, physically interfering with you, they have a right to videotape you, and you should keep that in mind when you behave. And I think we are learning, at least in our city, how the officers do in fact behave, because they know it could be anyone who has a cell phone camera like you do here for your Facebook.
Exactly. And it's something that I've said in a couple of forums where I said, you know, there are black bodies in our streets because there are not enough black bodies in our seats that police and create policy for the streets that we are dying in. If we have more people that are in positions of power creating policies about how police interact with their neighborhoods and regulating and overseeing police activities, you will see a change in the system and how it's interacting and how police are interacting in black neighborhoods.
Last month, a judge ruled that Cesar Goodson, the Baltimore police officer who drove the van that carried Freddie Gray, was not guilty on all charges. DeRay McKesson, the prominent activist in Baltimore who recently ran for mayor, said that verdict was a reminder, quoting here, that current laws protect police behavior policies and practices at all costs. How do you see it?
You know, I will be honest. I have not fully followed the Freddie Gray case for a couple of reasons. But one of the things that I think people need to very fully understand is that, one, he's being tried before a judge. And so it's a very different it's a different process than if there was a full citizen jury that's handling this case. And I think that is, you know, in part some of the reasons that that there have not been convictions. That, of course, is his right, you know, the officer's rights to do that. I think the judges are going based on the letter of the law, which is one of the reasons you ask a judge to try these cases. And I think that he's definitely right in the fact that we do need to address how laws are written and how judges are interpreting the laws that are written, and whether or not we need to tighten up the language, which is one of the reasons why, you know, sitting in the legislature, especially being an attorney that sits in the legislature, I look at what's coming before us. I look at the way that our laws are currently written. The fight that I even take on domestic violence is directly related to the fact that the way that our laws are written currently, there is a whole swath of victims that are unprotected by our court system.
We're going to talk about domestic violence with Angela Angel. She's a member of the Maryland House of Delegates. She's a Democrat who represents the 25th District. Tom Sherman.
Well, this is the same thing that's playing out on the national stage with FBI Director Comey and his remarks, detailed remarks earlier this week about the Hillary Clinton emails, where he gave horrendous examples of misbehavior by State Department employees, perhaps, and Hillary Clinton herself about what she could have done or should have done. But he came down and said, under the law, there was no prosecuting offense that he could recommend to the Justice Department. And, of course, that has incensed the Republicans and conservatives who think she should be in jail. But this is where the law, what the work you do in the General Assembly and what people do in Congress is so very important. A few words here or there can make a huge difference. And so maybe that's a good segue into domestic violence, which is a huge issue day in and day out.
Angela Angel, you're convening a community forum in Prince George's this weekend about domestic violence, an issue where you were very active in the General Assembly this past year. What are you hoping to achieve with this conversation?
One of the biggest things that we're hoping to achieve with the conversation is to begin having both policymakers and policy implementers. So that's we have the head of the county council, we have the sheriff's office, we have the sitting family court judge, as well as we have the state's attorney's office. So those are the policy implementers that are having discussions with survivors and with service providers about this is what the policy says. So like you said, language is important, but this is what is actually happening. on the ground. And so we can begin to see the loopholes and where we need to tighten up language and where services are lacking, and also where we need to put funding to help people get out of these situations, to help abusers get the help that they need, so that hopefully we can overcome some of the systemic things that are creating these cycles. All of that is what we want to get out of this discussion.
Part of treat, can we give where this event is? Treat and enforcement. It's the domestic violence at our doorstep. It's tomorrow, Saturday, from 10 to 12 at the Glenarden First Baptist Church,
yes,
which is right near 50 and 495.
Exactly, at the Ministry Center, because the church has two locations. It's okay. At the Ministry Center.
Is that in St. General? Okay.
Yes.
Google it if you don't know.
It's my understanding that a part of your interest in this issue is personal. Would you be willing to share that?
Absolutely. It's interesting because when I didn't share it for a long time, but it's one of the reasons that I feel the actual need to share my experience is because I sit in rooms too often with policymakers who trivialize what people go through and don't understand how the behaviors that we're trying to change affect people. I actually was a victim of domestic violence and then was a victim of a ongoing and very systemic harassment once I had... I was no longer physically in contact with my abuser, and he could no longer physically harm me. And I went to the courts basically asking for a restraining order. At the time, my estranged husband was, you know, creating havoc in my home, calling my job, calling me nonstop. Literally, I would be up all night. I had phone records and text messages where, you know, I was not sleeping. And when the body doesn't get sleep, you know, it was just a very chaotic, traumatizing situation. He was calling my job and threatening and harassing my coworkers. And literally, sitting in court, a judge said, "There's nothing that I can do to protect you in this instance. The law itself does not allow me to issue an order
because it wasn't violent, physically violent." That's essentially what the judge was saying, right?
Exactly.
That's because the law says domestic violence is you imagine and you picture someone being beaten and assaulted, not being harassed every moment of the day.
And you were talking about other forms of abuse.
Right.
Exactly. And even though the actual harassment is a crime, and you can actually go get a criminal case began and criminal action, but you can't get protection to actually have the behavior stop.
The stay-away order.
Exactly.
What did you learn about how Annapolis works by engaging on this issue during the past year? It turned out that getting this bill passed was not exactly an easy thing to do.
No, and actually the language for this type of change has been around for almost 15 years and in different forms. And basically there is kind of a general sense of, and this is actually when talking about any type of domestic violence or even, you know, when we talk about sexual assaults and a lot of things, crimes against women, there is a constant prevailing thought process of, well, someone could be lying. That victims will use this to harm men, that it will be used in, you know, people talk about child support cases, or it will be used, you know, it's basically what we call the hysterical woman doctrine, that women will use any type of these actions as a, you know, as a form of control and as a form to get after. To go against men. And so that is actually the prevailing thought and the prevailing discussion that happens in these rooms.
And you heard that from the Judicial Proceedings Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, both.
In both spaces.
Specific people said that to you directly.
Yes. And I mean, if you hear some of the hearings that have gone back and forth on the issues, it's raised exactly. You know, that's something that is definitely, you know, they talk about it on record.
How do you fix that? That's the argument you hear a lot, that an offended, an aggrieved spouse goes to a court and says the most horrible things that could possibly be done, that she or he hasn't been hit, but here's what that person has done, just to embarrass the spouse, just to cause trouble, just to maybe... how do you write the law so that that people who say, I haven't been physically abused, but I've been mentally tormented, and my family has been mentally tormented? How can you write a law that does that but protects from the what people would call frivolous or vengeful attempts to get at spouses?
Well, you craft it very tightly, because I do agree. There is a small, but it's much smaller, a small percentage of bad actors who will use any form of law to go after someone.
There are zillions of frivolous lawsuits, for example.
Exactly. And currently, you could walk into court today and say, someone hit me. And you know, frivolously and pursue a claim. One of the things that we did is we very tightly construed the definition of harassment. It must be ongoing. It must not have any legal relevance, meaning it can't be that he's contacting you constantly about the children. You know, it must be that you've asked them to stop. And it must be something, and we actually included language that says a judge has to have a finding that a reasonable person, if suffering these acts, would be under distress. It would cause mental or emotional distress. So there's a opportunity for judges who I think interact with these victims on a regular basis who understand the difference between a frivolous claim and a non-frivolous claim.
You wrote it tightly. You tried to end around by attaching it to an amendment. But what are your hopes for where this issue is headed when you come back to Annapolis next year?
When we return next year, I mean, we did one of the great things about what we did this year is we were able to shine a light on it. Victims were able to tell their stories. And so we did get some commitments that we're working on the language with the heads of the committee, with other lawmakers who are willing to work on the language and agree and come to something that we can agree upon and support.
Can I ask one quick question?
No.
I'm going to do it anyway. Actually, that was one question. State's Attorney Angela Alsobrooks has made domestic violence an issue for her. Are you guys working together? Are you working alongside each other? Are you in parallel efforts?
The Angela team.
Yeah, she's been on this program talking about this subject, and yep. It's particularly worrisome for her in Prince George's County.
Absolutely, because State's Attorney Alsobrooks addresses and confronts it on a very regular basis. She's been very helpful. She's testified on our bills. She's a strong supporter. Her office is going to be on the panel, so it's something that we work on together.
Great. Angela Angel, she's a member of the Maryland House of Delegates who represents the state's 25th district. She's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us very shortly will be Sandra Matavus-Fry, People's Counsel for the District of Columbia, and we'll be talking about PEPCO and that rate hike, so you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. Is this something you're looking forward to? You can send us email to kojo@wamu.org, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream. Tom, where did you watch the fireworks on Monday night?
I live in Southwest, and we have an unparalleled view of the fireworks, except when the clouds don't agree. So I was on my roof to watch the fireworks, and I realized that the fireworks, when they started, you could not see them. You could see them going up, but you could not see them burst into all their
glory. You could see them if you were watching PBS. Yes.
Well, but then so I went downstairs, and I left the door open to my balcony so that I could hear the fireworks, and I turned on to watch the Capitol 4th, which is a great program on Capitol Hill, and the fireworks were gorgeous. They were just beautiful. And I said something about how I had done this marvelous thing on Twitter, that I was listening to the fireworks and watching them, and somebody said, well, sure, but you know they're fake, and of course then I started looking, and I was horrified that the fireworks, in fact, were good ones from previous years by PBS, were interspersed into the dull ones, the clouded ones this year. And it was terrible.
And PBS has since apologized for that, because you can't tell people that they're watching
something.
They first
said it was patriotic, and somebody said, what the hell does patriotic mean when you're faking the fireworks?
Yes, you can't say tell
anyway,
people they're
it's
watching
over.
One
I don't think that'll happen again.
Right, that lip sync, what was that, Bruce?
Sandra Matavus-Fry, did you watch the fireworks on PBS?
I did not.
You do your own fireworks.
She creates her own fireworks. She joins us in studio. Sandra Matavus-Fry is the People's Counsel for the District of Columbia. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Good afternoon,
If you have questions or comments, call us at 800-433-8850. Watch our live video stream at kojoshow.org. We'll talk about PEPCO's recent rate increase in a minute, but first let's talk about the context in which this request was made. You were one of the city's most outspoken opponents of the PEPCO-Exelon merger until Mayor Bowser approved a revised deal last year. Shortly after, Mayor Bowser nominated you for another term. A couple of council members who did not support your reappointment. They opposed your reappointment. They said they did it because your decision to ultimately support the merger, or I shouldn't say ultimately because that was in the middle, your decision to support the merger was what they considered a lapse in judgment. How would you describe the ways you came to view this merger while it was on the table?
Well, thank you for the question, Kojo. It's a question that has plagued me
for some
time now, and it was raised by Councilmember Che during my confirmation hearing, as you may recall. And it was distressing.
Yes, she was very upset.
It was distressing because I have worked assiduously throughout the course of this proceeding from the very beginning. OPC, as you recognized, and me personally, we were ardent opponents of the merger as it was proposed. It was the 14 million, and I came on this program and we talked about it extensively. And the $14 million that was originally opposed was a laugh. It was a joke and it was an insult to the District of Columbia. And we opposed it strenuously for numerous reasons. First, it was too little. And secondly, the benefits were lopsidedly applied to shareholders, with consumers getting absolutely no benefits at all, including any renewable issues or any, you know, sustainability issues being imposed. During the course of the trial, the joint applicants, Pepco and Exelon, raised the ante, so to speak, to $33 million. I consistently opposed that as well for the same basic reasons, that it did not give consumers, everyday consumers, sufficient benefits. Subsequent to that, the commission agreed with many of the points that OPC made and denied the application. Subsequent to that, the applicants approached the mayor's office, I assume, as well as the other parties, and proposed a new deal, so to speak. So the issue was, and has always been for me, that it's, and contrary to the comments of some of the opponents, it wasn't that I changed. It was that the joint applicants changed their position substantially. It was five times the original offer, and it offered significant benefits that had not been put on the table previously, including, you know, as I mentioned, renewable issues and, you know, interconnectivity issues, benefits for low-income consumers, and a residential offset, which was another issue, which was one of the issues that I had strenuously supported during the course.
They changed, the applicants changed their position, causing you to come around and approve it, but then you switched back to opposing the merger. What caused that?
And that was because the commission, in approving, well, the commission actually rejected the settlement proposal, that the part that the office, my office,
the mayor's
as well
proposal,
as
essentially. The one that she led.
Ones that the mayor led, they rejected that. But the part that they rejected that affected me and my office was the part that I really strenuously supported, which was the residential offset. And that was the $26.5 million, which would have offset any increases to residential consumers until 2019.
That relief ultimately was to be spread out over all ratepayers, not just homeowners, and that's where you got upset with it. I think we could all suffer. I don't know how you've been on the Office of People's Counsel since 1984. Is that right? You've been the director since 2011, I believe. Is that correct?
That's about.
You know all this history. But for a radio show on the Politics Hour, where do we stand now? Both you and Attorney General Carl Racine have issued public statements saying he's even said he was looking at whether he could go to court to stop this. You've said you would very carefully review it. Where did Pepco and Exelon are moving right ahead with their reforms and the rate increases that some people think are tied to this, others say they're not. But where do we stand now? You're going to carefully look at it, but when do you take action?
Indeed, we got a tweet from Caroline who says, I'd like to know where things stand on the Office of the People's Council decision on whether to appeal PSC's approval of the PEPEX merger.
Well, that was pretty good. I said better than me, but where do we stand?
You're correct. We are looking very, very carefully at the commission's decision. An appeal is a significant step. And when we move forward, we want to make certain that it is a reasonable use of ratepayer funds. The exact date would be in mid-August. We have 60 days from the date when the commission issued its order on reconsideration, which was June 30th, I believe that was the date. So toward the end of August, we will have to make a decision.
And you could either challenge the merger, or is there something short of that you could do?
We would challenge the commission's decision on the merger. You know, my major concern, you know, obviously...
When the commission approved the merger in March, you said the decision was legally flawed. Is that the basis on which you're pursuing
The basis
now?
For which we would decide, determine whether or not to appeal, is whether or not the commission committed legal error in rendering its decision. Now, legal error would be, you know, whether or not there was sufficient due process, whether or not there was adequate notice, whether or not the commission followed its own rules, whether or not it was clear and unambiguous in making its decisions. Those are the standards for review before the D.C. Court of Appeal. Now, the commission is given wide discretion by the D.C. Court of Appeals, and I believe some of the commenters have indicated that it's very difficult burden on anyone that is filing an appeal, and that is true. However, the office has successfully filed appeals against the commission in the past. Indeed, during my administration, my 3 or 4 years as People's Counsel, we have successfully challenged the commission's decision. But, and that's why I will look at it with, you know, really scrutinize the merits of an appeal, the value of an appeal, and what we can hope to learn from it.
The public 433-8850, how do you feel about the Pepco-Exelon merger, and in particular about the rate increase? Do you think ultimately this will mean something good for consumers in the District of Columbia? Give us a call, 800-433-8850.
The Public Service Commission has 3 members. Betty Ann Kane is the chairman. She has consistently voted against the merger, saying it was not good for the ratepayers. Commissioner Willie Phillips and Commissioner Joanne Dottie Fort are the ones who voted 2-1 for this to go forward.
It's amazing how you remember all these people's names. But go ahead.
I write them down, Coach. So who are you trying you want the court? Who made the mistake in your view? Was it Commissioner Fort? Was it Commissioner Phillips?
Well, I view the commission's order in its totality. Commissioner Kane has been consistently opposing the merger. Commissioner Fort originally opposed the filing that the company made, the application. She disagreed and supported the settlement
right.
agreement.
She's been on each side.
Right. However, from my perspective, and how we will look at even the appeal, is that ultimately the commission rejected the settlement proposal.
Okay. Now, is she up for reappointment? Ms. Ford, is she up? Where is the status? In my understanding, she's up for reappointment. I mean, you got criticism because you were up for reappointment
right.
when you supported the mayor's people. Said, oh, well, you did it because
right.
you got reappointed.
And that was the optics that you can't
you
get
can't,
away from.
You, right. So, but is Ms. Ford, where does Ms. Ford stand? Is her term up or over? I think it's up to some past summer, wasn't it?
I believe, and you know, correct me, I can be corrected if I'm incorrect, that her term ended on June 30th, but she would have the 180 days holdover. But
I
don't know anything.
I checked,
beyond
it does end
that.
On June 30th. Is the politics of this worried? I mean, and I mean by politics, not obviously elective politics, but just a commissioner whose term is up. Less willing to, I don't know, I'm just trying, is there any politics involved with this?
I am.
The same thing you were accused of.
Exactly. And I will not, you know, move forward on that type of a discussion. I think that, you know, as for myself, you know, my integrity speaks for itself. I've had 25 years of working for and on behalf of consumers in the District of Columbia. I'm an attorney. I value my reputation. And I would say the same for Commissioner Ford.
When you filed testimony with the D.C. Public Service Commission in 2014, you predicted that this merger would cause higher rate increases. So what was your reaction when you heard the rate increase request?
I was surprised but not shocked.
Okay.
And I say that because during the course of the proceeding, I was surprised at the magnitude of the rate increase proposal. It is the highest rate increase proposal that has been filed in the District of Columbia for over 2 decades. And if you really compare apples to apples, it is, in my view, the highest that has ever been filed. In the 80s, there was a case that was filed, 785, for about $90 million. But you have to remember that that's when the company was vertically integrated. So that was assessed against the entire amount. In this instance, we're talking about $85 million for distribution rates only.
Right.
So that is significant.
Well, Pepco, it says in its defense, that it said early on in this rate case that it was it often asked for a rate case virtually every year, but it said it was delaying or postponing any rate requests until this hearing on the merger was done. And now that the merger was done, they said they would in fact be looking for a rate increase whether the merger went forward or not. Many opponents of the merger are insisting that this rate increase is the direct result of the merger and the gouging of the consumers. Where do you stand on that?
I think it's a fair question, to be perfectly honest.
I'd rather have a fair answer.
Well, I'm going to give you the answer that I can give you.
Okay. Is it gouging?
$85 million is a lot of money, and we're going to have to look at it to see.
Well,
you're
going to look at the merger, you're going to look at the rate. I mean, you know.
I cannot make a decision.
We want you to characterize.
An
we want you to get beyond looking and characterize.
Is it gouging, and you want to see if it can be sustained? Or, I mean,
I don't think so. I believe that these are fair questions. I don't know if I made the point, but I wanted to make the point that during the course of the proceeding, the company said that they would file a rate increase of about they thought they would file about $55 million.
That's why you were not surprised.
And that's why I was not surprised. So the question becomes, how did they get from 55 to 85 in 2 months? It's an ask.
Right, okay.
Remember that. This is an ask. So don't be, we need to be concerned with how we scrutinize this. And I know you're asking me, well, what do you think? I think that there is some gamesmanship going on.
What is the timetable then? We now know that, and whether you'll challenge a merger, mm-hmm. if that's at late August. What is the time frame for challenging the rate increase, which I would assume would be acted on and go into effect later this year if it's not stopped?
No, it'll go into the likely, if we go by the commission's schedule, generally it takes about 9 months to a year.
Early next year, maybe.
So early, next year, toward the end of next year. But the proceeding and the trial will probably occur in January-ish, February. And then the commission will render a decision, probably if they follow their normal procedures.
PEPCO, they're not here. That's why I'm raising
this issue. Well, I'm saying, tell you what they say. What they said on this show. They said that the money from the rate increase will go towards cost recovery that PEPCO has spent to upgrade equipment the past 3 years. PEPCO's counsel was on this broadcast. He said that the upgrade will save residents money in the future. What do you think?
That there are fewer outages and that the outages are responded to more quickly is their view.
Well, I think that the point was also made that those reliability gains have been occurring for some time. And we are at a better place.
Did you say games or gains?
Gains.
I said gains. No, they've been gains.
G-A-I-N-S.
There have been fewer outages and because they're fewer, the durations have been lower. So those are gains. But we remember that we really fought for those reliability measures and to ensure that, consumers had their power on and that when it was off, it was turned on before. So you can't really take credit for that, and it certainly shouldn't be something that they use as evidence of lower rates.
Here's a tweet we got from LaTuck. PEPCO was neglectful of its infrastructure for years. Now it wants to be rewarded for remedying its neglect. No deal, says LaTuck.
That's absolutely correct. They were... And it's interesting because what happened, in fact, was that because of the moratorium that was associated with divestiture so long ago, the company really did very minimal upgrades because they couldn't recover it through rates. And then subsequent to the ending of the moratorium, they filed rate cases on an annual basis. And that's, in fact, what happened.
This is not unlike Metro, where Metro didn't do deferred maintenance endlessly until it got to be a crisis. Now they're saying we need all this money to fix what we didn't do over a period of 40 years.
Exactly. So it's similar, just on a much shorter basis.
Here's Mark in Washington, D.C. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. And, I do want to say first that, I never doubt the integrity of the commissioner. And
of the People's Council?
With the People's Council, but what I would also say is that the people were obviously against this merger, and I think that was clear. I mean, every public forum that I went to, the overwhelming majority of people were against the merger. People who knew Exelon were always saying that.
So what do you think happened?
What I think happened is that, like you said, gamesmanship happened, but I also feel that money talked, you know, and that big money won over the interest.
What do you think should happen now?
I think that the merger should be blocked. I think that, it should be put to a vote, a referendum for the people, and that we should go by that as to whether they want this merger or not. I think we just got in trouble with TEPCO. Okay.
Thank you very much, Sandra Matavus-Frank. Mm-hmm. Care to comment on that? Referendums, block the merger. Is that possible at this point?
I don't believe that we have the political ability to do a referendum. It is a investor-owned utility, so there would be all sorts of taking issues and constitutional issues. However, I've heard that there is some. I know that there is discussion on municipal utilities. I don't know if that was.
Your office has recently assembled a team to monitor this merger agreement, and if the team concludes that the merger is not in the best interest of residents, would you appeal a recent commission decision that struck down a challenge to the merger?
What the settlement agreement reflects and contains and requires is that if there is failure to comply, the parties, including my office, and we certainly will take advantage of that, we have an opportunity to approach the commission and ask them to overturn the merger itself.
We just have about a minute
left. So that's
less than that now.
Very quickly, will you respond? You're a person of color. You have adult children. What are you thinking about when you hear about all the police, the shootings of the police officers? And that just, what are you thinking as a citizen of the city?
It is so tragic. I mean, that is, you know, foremost on my mind. I have a son. He's not a young adult anymore, but I have an adult son, and I have a young grandson. So just to think of the tragedy or the possibility of that type of violence being directed at them is mind-boggling. It is what keeps me up at night. And I'm just very concerned.
What advice do you give to them if they're confronted by police?
What advice can you give when you have random and wanton acts of violence? You know, clearly you say be calm, be responsive, do not try and take on this police officer. But that doesn't seem to be a protection.
I'm afraid
it's awful. I'm concerned for the country. I really am. I'm concerned for our city. I am concerned for our country.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Sandra Matavus-Frey is People's Counsel for the District of Columbia. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening on our website. We've put together a list there of our recent conversations on police accountability and race that you can check at our blog at kojoshow.org/blog. The list includes everything from interviews with authors like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who spoke with us last fall about policing in Prince George's County, to conversations with police officials and local lawmakers and activists. Remember, you can always take the show with you via your favorite podcast app, and be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll continue that conversation about how the region is still wrestling with questions about policing and race with Prince George's County Chief Hank Stawinski. We'll also chat with philanthropist and former Washington Wizards and Capitals owner Irene Poland. Until then, Tom Sherwood, have a nice weekend. Sandra Matavus-Frey, you have a nice weekend.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.